Chair Pappas and members of the committee, this chair feels short. Let's see. Okay, there we go. thank you. My name is Jennifer Ho, and I'm the Commissioner of Minnesota Housing, and excited to talk to you a little bit today about our public housing preservation program. This is the only GEO bond program that the agency has used. We also have appropriations bonds, but those are being done in the Housing Committee, is my understanding. So I'll just be talking about the public housing rehab and not about the housing infrastructure bonds. Just since it's my first time seeing some of you this year, I wanted to just start by just a very brief overview that Minnesota Housing is kind of the state's housing bank, and we're really considered one of the leading state housing finance agencies in the country, not just by ourselves, but by national financial advisors, rating agencies, and others. We have bond issuance authority, and therefore we are rated by Moody's and Standard & Poor's. We have a AA-plus bond rating. And really very important that we demonstrate a sound management of financial resources, since we do have this relationship with bondholders as well as tax credit purchasers in our housing programs. But not every housing finance agency in the country enjoys the partnership with the legislature that Minnesota Housing does, and I always say it's our partnership with you that makes us one of the best. The state bonding and the state appropriations allow us to do more and reach further than other state housing finance agencies are able to do. We have a large homeownership mortgage portfolio that we do with a network of mortgage lenders around the country, which is a large part of activity that you don't always see, but it's an important part of what we do. I just wanted to briefly talk about housing needs, although I know you all know this because when I visit with you, you talk to me about the housing needs in your districts. But there, we have a lot of cost burden households, which means people that are paying a large portion of their income for rent, the federal standard being 30% of income for rent. So these are folks who are paying more than that. And if you take a look at this map of the state, you can see that the impact on households who are cost burdened is distributed across the state. It's not just relative to any specific region of the state. And the main reason why we have this challenge is that when you take a look at the number of renter households who are whose households make 30% of area median income or less, that's over 175,000 households. When you take a look at the number of units that we actually have that are affordable to households that way, we have a big gap generally. But we also have a lot of households who make more than 30, could afford a place that was more expensive, but obviously we don't kick people out of housing just because they make more. In fact, that's the way we get ahead, is by not paying such a large percentage of our income on rent. But it's this disconnect between where we have units that are deeply affordable and the number of households who need those units that creates some of the disconnect. It's one of the reasons that we view the HUD-funded public housing portfolio as a really important part of the deeply affordable rental housing market across the state of Minnesota. So through the public housing authorities across the state, public housing serves about 36,000 low-income households in the built public housing. That includes about 12,000 children. There's a high percentage of seniors and people with disabilities, and many of the people who live in public housing have extremely low incomes, fixed incomes of $15,000 a year or less. And since HUD stopped building these buildings quite a long time ago, more than 95% of public housing buildings are over 35 years old. So the Public Housing Preservation State General Obligation Bonds is what I want to walk through here now. The governor's bonding recommendations includes $60 million of GEO bonds for public housing rehabilitation. Just as an aside, it also includes $20 million of cash on the budget appropriations side, but $60 million proposed for public housing preservation. This is just a quote about how important it is to create jobs, but also to make sure that we have things that are really supporting what communities need. The public-owned housing program, affectionately known as POP, was established by the Minnesota Legislature back in 2005. It was really created to rehabilitate and preserve these public housing units. When we work with a public housing authority, funds are provided in the form of a 20-year deferred forgivable loan to an HRA, a housing redevelopment authority, or a PHA, a public housing authority that operate public housing. We award it statewide on a competitive basis, and we really prioritize requests for funding that prioritize life and safety, accessibility, or energy efficiency. We have been prioritizing projects to be able to put fire suppression systems into these buildings. Those sprinkler systems weren't available when these buildings were originally created. So the GEO bonds provide the funding source to preserve these units, make sure that they have kind of minimum health and safety benefits, but can also do some quality of life improvements as well. If you take a look at recent history, in the last decade, we received GEO bond authorization in 12, 14, 17, 18, and 20. The amounts, the largest amount ever was $20 million back in 2014. So across the last 10 years, $61.5 million GEO bond authorized. We've put out 60.2 for 116 projects and 8,700 units. So that's the impact the program has had over the course of the last, well, I guess it's a little bit more than a decade, going back to 2012. So what's an example of what these dollars do? In 2018, we did almost a $600 million deal with the Housing and Redevelopment Authority of Laverne. They had a seven-story, 70-unit development that was built in 1971 that worked with people of all ages, including seniors and people with physical and emotional disabilities. As you can see in this before picture, the building was not designed to be easily accessible by a person who uses a wheelchair. If you take a look at the next slide, this is after work had been done. So it was a critical roof replacement. There was a fire alarm panel, an ADA accessible entrance, a double door entrance, which improves security, also an emergency backup generator. So some pretty basic things to improve the accessibility, safety, as well as the longevity of the building.
Commissioner, do you have any idea why this, a building for seniors and people with disabilities, would be built in 1971 without an accessible door? Was it built originally, do you know, for another purpose?
Yeah, I don't have an answer to that specifically on this building, but I'll find it for you. I mean, I believe that all these buildings would have been built to what code was at the time that they were built.
Oh.
Yeah, pre-ADA.
Huh. Oh, pre-ADA, yeah. But still, if you're building it for people who have these issues, it seems odd to me.
Our thinking around these things has evolved.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, it's possible that the building would have shifted the populations that it served over time, but my guess is that there have always been people with disabilities and always been seniors in many of these projects. Another example here in St. Paul is the Wabasha high-rise. That was just about a $900,000 deal. It's a six-story high-rise that was built in 1969, owned and managed by the St. Paul Public Housing Authority, 70 units, efficiency, and one bedrooms. It also has a diverse group of low-income single adults. This was around really important masonry work, where the outside of the building was falling down, which was an issue for the people who lived there, but also for the people who walked by. Another example, the Viking Tower.
Sorry, before you move on, this is in my district. So if any of the members live downtown and you happen to be taking Wabasha to come from downtown to the Capitol, you drive right past this housing development. It's right on the left side, right before you cross the freeway.
Thank you, Chair Pappas. Another example from Alexandria, and I think this is a great example because oftentimes you can tell what the public housing is in a smaller town. Oftentimes it's the tallest high-rise in a community. The Viking Tower was over $2 million deal from 2018. This also was built in 1969. It's 106 one-bedroom units, and it's owned and managed by the Alexandria Housing and Redevelopment Authority. I don't know how well this picture comes through, but that was kind of the HVAC system. And if you take a look at the next slide, the funds allowed them to complete work on the mechanical and plumbing systems. The old and failing systems were causing serious water leaks and issues, as well as temperature control issues and ventilation issues. So by upgrading those systems, no longer having to worry about leaks, better air quality, better temperature control. So that's really just the quick summary that I wanted to put together. I worked at HUD. I know that HUD, basically has left a lot of the public housing it helped create in the 60s and the 70s fall into disrepair. They have not adequately funded the deferred capital needs of these buildings. We have stepped in as a state to make sure that we preserve these important community assets so that we have high quality rental housing that is supported by HUD. It's affordable to people at very low incomes. They only pay 30% of their income on rent. And also make sure that these community assets are viewed as positive assets and not kind of a rundown or dangerous building in the communities that they serve. So happy to take any questions.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. There's a program through DEED called the Minnesota Housing Grant, Greater Minnesota Housing Grants Program. Is that something that you all are involved with? Or do you know about that program?
I'm giving Dan a meaningful
look. Mr. Kitzberger, do you know?
Chair.
Madam Chair, you may be referring to the Greater Minnesota Workforce Housing Development
Yes.
Program that was previously housed at DEED. Came over to Minnesota Housing, I think, in 2016.
Okay.
But we now administer that program. It's an appropriated program, $2 million a year for specifically for new rental development outside of the metro area.
Great. Thank you. And generally, do the local finance like public housing finance agencies, are they usually the ones that apply for this program, or are there other, could it come through cities, or who usually makes the application, Commissioner?
Thank you, Chair. The Greater Minnesota Workforce Development Program is oftentimes a partnership between a private developer and a city. Mm-hmm. Public housing authorities haven't really been in the building business from time to time. I'm remembering being up in the city of Eveleth, I think in my first year as commissioner, for a grand opening of a new senior project that the local housing authority had done. There's some rehab stuff that's being done, but there aren't a lot of public housing authorities that have inside of their charters authority to just build outside of the HUD infrastructure.
So it's more unusual that St. Paul has a public housing authority.
There are over 400 public housing authorities in the state, but they were largely created as a conduit for HUD financing. Both of the built public housing pieces that are owned, and then as a conduit for private developers to do rental, low-income rental, and targeted rental for seniors or people with disabilities. They also manage the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program, where people use a rental voucher in the private market.
Any questions from members of the committee? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will then move on to the Department of Agriculture with and the Minnesota Rural Finance Authority. And welcome, Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, my name is Tom Peterson. I'm the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and we're here today to present our two bonding-related proposals for both the Rural Finance Authority, which essentially is kind of our bank at the Department of Agriculture. It does a lot of great work on behalf of farmers and rural Minnesotans, and also our potato facility in East Grand Forks. And so,
before you get started, Commissioner, I just really want to thank you for attending our joint meeting we had with the Agriculture Committee to talk about food insecurity. It was great to have you there. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to always connect those. So I'm just going to be brief and turn it over to them, and we can move on from there. So, he's okay. We have the wrong connection.
Yeah. You need some assistance from us?
I'll turn it over to Mr. McDevitt, who is the director of our Rural Finance Authority.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. My name is Matt McDevitt. I'm the Ag Finance Supervisor for the Rural Finance Authority. Apologize for the confusion there. Wrong. New computers don't have all the same hookups. Okay, I'm just going to start out, give you just a brief history of the RFA. So it was established in 1986 during the farm crisis with the Restructure Loan Program. Shortly thereafter, in 87, the Beginning Farmer Loan Program was added. That currently is our most popular program, comprising about 70% of the actual loans that we issue. I won't go through every other single loan program here on the list, but there's quite a few that have been added over the years. So the purpose of the RFA is to provide eligible Minnesota farmers affordable financing under terms and conditions not necessarily available from other credit sources. So we target beginning farmers, livestock producers, farmers that are facing some financial adversity. Ideally, we work with full-time farmers, which means the majority of their income does come from farming, and that would be on a gross income basis. So some of the goals of the RFA is obviously help Minnesota farmers, but we also help out local institutions like the local banks. So we help them be competitive with our loan products. We work with them, and ours are lower interest rates. We share risk with them, and we manage local lending limits. So we're pretty easy to use with a prompt approval process. We're somewhere probably under a week right now. And we use the local lenders supporting loan documentation in our approval process. So how are we funded? So we're funded through the sale of state bonds. So we sell these bonds, RFA has to pay them back. So the last appropriation that we received was $50 million in 2020. So the programs that are funded with these bond funds are the Beginning Farmer and Seller Assisted Loans, Agricultural Improvement, Livestock Expansion, and the Restructure. We have some other programs, but I'm just going to stick to the bond-funded ones today.
Excuse me, Mr. McDevitt. Do you have are these appropriation bonds, or are they GO bonds, or some other kind?
Madam Chair, members, they're GO bonds.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so bonding dollars. Currently, we have about $19 million left on the 2020 authorization of $50 million. So recently we've received quite a few loan requests due to the high interest rate environment and the fact that our rates are considerably lower as we bought in during a lower interest rate period. So currently we expect to exhaust the fund somewhere around October of 2023. So right now there's the governor's proposal is to request $40 million in bonding authorization. Just a general overview of the program. So we've issued over 3,800 loans, totaling over $362 million from the beginning of the program till now. We've only taken losses on 21 loans, and from a dollar amount standpoint, that represents 0.002% of the money that has been lent. We currently have 742 active loans for approximately $100 million. So how do we work? So we do what are called participation loans, and we participate with local lenders in that we take 45% of the overall loan up to each program's maximum. So the local lender does most of the paperwork. The local lender actually does lend out the entire loan, but then we come in after the fact and buy 45% of the loan from them after it closes. So the borrower then pays the lender, and then the lender pays us as far as repayments go. We do have a 5-year prepayment penalty. And I've got a little example here to just kind of give you a general idea how this works. So somebody is buying a $200,000 property. Maybe they'll put 40 down, so they need 160. And then RFA will take 45% at 72,000, the lender 55% at 88. And, you know, currently that these are probably fairly close. That is our interest rate at 4% now. Your local lenders might fluctuate a little, but they're 6.5-ish. So the blended interest rate on this loan would be considerably less than if the lender was providing all the funds. So the RFA also works in tandem with FSA, as there's many of these loans for beginning farmers. So when we do that, the FSA will waive the 1% origination fee. They will agree to issue 95% guarantees on the loans that we do. And they will also go a 20-year balloon rather than just a 10-year balloon. Oh, sorry, FSA is USDA Farm Service Agency. I want to be assuming everybody knows that acronym. So we'll do a longer balloon on these loans. So it's even a better deal for the farmers. So just super brief example of how that works. So the FSA comes in and they might lend, you know, $225,000 at 1.5. We'll lend our remaining 45% of the total. The lender takes 55% of the total. Their blended interest rate probably at this point is going to come around somewhere in the 3-4% range. As compared to if the local lender was doing it, the whole thing would be at somewhere between 6-7%. So really helps the beginning farmers cash flow and have a greater chance for success. Another program with this here is the agricultural improvement loan. So this is for finance improvements on farm for any ag-related purposes, such as livestock buildings, grain handling facilities, machine storage, and manure systems. The net worth on this is capped at $903,000. We'll do a $400,000 loan, and we lend that out at 4.25. Livestock expansion, so that to help create state-of-the-art livestock production facilities like hog barns, poultry barns, cattle barns, robotic milkers, and such. We can go a net worth as high as $1,919,000 on these, and our loan amount can cap out at $525,000. Right now we're at 4.5% interest rate on that program. We do restructure loans, so these help farmers reorganize their debt to improve their cash flow. So also the higher net worth on this one at $1,919,000. We can do up to $525,000 from the RFA and 4.5% interest rate on the restructure program. I think I mentioned the prepayment penalty starts at 10%. It's 2%, reduces 2% a year. The borrower can always pay an additional principal up to 10% without any penalty in a given year. And we are limited to 10 years balloon, except when the FSA is involved, we can go to 20. But we will amortize the loans out up to 30 years to also help cash flow. I will now stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner, Mr. McDevitt. So I'm going back a few pages. You said you expect to exhaust your loans by October of 2023, and the last time you had an authorization was in 2020 of $50 million. So you're working through that, and you've got about $19 million left. Okay. So it sounds like it'd be a good idea to add to your pile of money add to your bank account this year. Any other questions from, yeah, Senator Housley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming today. If in the governor's proposal it's $40 million, would you still be able to use it if it were just $40 million in the bonding bill?
Madam Chair, members, so the way this works is we will sell bonds in chunks, so we generally don't sell the entire appropriation all at once, because we can do up to yearly bond sales. So we try to be appropriate with how much money we have sitting around and then are paying interest on and not lending out. So we will kind of piecemeal it out year by year, determining how much we think we're going to lend, and we kind of chip away at the overall appropriation. I believe we have 5 years in which to go through all that before we it would just kind of go back and we'd have to start over again.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, I believe you're. This is being heard in the Ag Committee tomorrow, I think I heard, and then I think you'll come here after that.
All right, good afternoon, my name is...
Oh, Nick. The other project, great, thank you.
good afternoon, my name is Nick Milanowski. I am the program supervisor for the Fruit, Vegetable, and Grain Unit within the Plant Protection Division with the MDA, and I'm here to talk about a building that we have in East Grand Forks. So this is a building that was built in 1993. It's about 8,000 square feet. It is a facility that to the direct east of this facility, we have the USDA Ag Research Station for potatoes, and we share a parking lot with the Northern Plains Potato Growers Association. I believe they are now called Northland Potatoes. So this building acts as a hub for potatoes right in East Grand Forks, right in the center of the Red River Valley. We've done two major improvements to this building, both through appropriations since it was built. One was a new roof in 08, and the other was new windows in 2015. Most of what we do out of this facility is potato related. We do seed potato certification. We do potato grading that happens through a cooperative agreement through the USDA. We also do some food safety audits for potato growers in the area, and we do potato cyst nematode survey out of there as well. Our seed potato certification program is a labor intensive program. It also has a lot of specialized things that happen at this facility. If we didn't have this facility, it would be really hard to execute on what we need to do. We have a laboratory, as you can see in one of these photos, where we are able to do disease testing and pathogen testing. I mentioned potato cyst nematode. We can also do ELISA testing or enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay testing for potato virus Y or other potato viruses that impact seed growers and commercial growers in the region.
Mr. Milanowski, what is so special about potatoes that they get their own facility for inspection?
Yeah, so seed potatoes are very unique, Madam Chair. Thank you, and members. Seed potatoes are very unique. So seed potatoes are grown clonally, and so that means that every progeny or daughter tuber is a clone of the mother tuber. And what that means is it is much more susceptible to disease and transfer of disease between the crops and the other potatoes that are growing in proximity to it. And so our goal as Seed to Potatoes Certification Agency is to verify that the disease tolerance is below the standards that Minnesota has set in rules, but also that we've agreed to with other seed potato certification agencies around the country and in Canada. So you can't ship potatoes that are above that disease tolerance to other states and sell them as seed. I hope that answers your question.
So is this what happened in the Irish potato famine?
It is, yes.
They succumbed to a disease.
Yes.
That's how we got so many people from Ireland in America.
So it is a very visual-based test and process, and so you can see one of our inspectors on the far right there, Kim McDonald. She is out looking at different viruses and how they manifest in these potatoes. We have the ability to go out to, or we have a requirement to go out to all these farms that are growing seed potatoes and inspect them 3 times a year. After we inspect them, we get tubers back to our facility in East Grand Forks, and we go and plant them in Hawaii. It might sound like a great gig. We get to go to Hawaii, grow out potatoes, but we are out there walking the fields of potatoes, predicting what next year's crop will look like and looking for disease to make sure that everything that goes out there as a seed potato from Minnesota is clean and of the highest standard.
How long have you been doing this?
Great question.
I don't mean you personally. I mean the department.
That's an excellent question, and I am unsure of that. The building's been in place since 93, but it's been before that for certain.
All right. Thank you. The Legislative Reference Library probably has that.
We also do a potato cyst nematode PCN survey. Again, a labor-intensive process. This requires some specialized equipment. In order to ship potatoes into Canada specifically and some other countries, you need to have a negative test of this soil-based nematode. Ultimately, the nematode reduces the yield of the potatoes, sometimes up to 80%. And so we have staff going out, collecting soil samples from fields, ensuring that it's negative. And our facility there has the ability to not only process the soil samples, but then also go through the laboratory and give the thumbs up or thumbs down on if they are positive for this nematode. And so, again, another labor-intensive process and specialized to this facility. The budget for these programs out of the East Grand Forks office are pretty thin. The largest chunk there for potato inspections also covers a processed potato inspection program, which is roughly $450,000 of that $510,000. So pretty thin budget, but we do our best with what we are appropriated and generate through fees. We also have interior space that we share and host events. So we have a working space, but also a conference room. So annually we host at least one meeting with the Minnesota Certified Seed Potato Growers Association. But we've also hosted meetings with Commissioner Peterson as well as Governor Walz in the past.
And I don't think the bonding committee has ever visited you. Not the Senate, anyway.
That's correct, Madam Chair. The House visited last fall, I believe.
Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I had an opportunity to go up and tour the facility. It was very impressive, and I learned a lot about potatoes that day.
Mm-hmm. I'm learning a lot right now.
As I mentioned before, we do have a specialized laboratory that allows us to test for the diseases that affect potatoes. We don't have all capabilities here. Our St. Paul lab does have some of those capabilities, and then we can also shop out some of the other lab testing that would be necessary. I mentioned the space for gathering our samples to go to Hawaii. That's what's in those green bags there. And then, of course, the meeting that we hosted with Commissioner Peterson and Governor Walz regarding the drought impact to the region several years ago. This was the largest space that we had available to us at the time, and so it served an excellent purpose there. So our proposed request in total is $440,000. It is intended to bring a lot of the systems that support this building up to current standards. Like I said, we haven't made many renovations since the 1993 building of the facility. And so we're looking to upgrade the lighting, HVAC, do some finishes through painting, carpet. We also have electrical panel modernization, replacement of the roof. Again, unfortunately, the weather up in East Grand Forks can be extreme, and we often need, almost every year, have had to do repairs to the roof, but have not yet had to replace it wholly. The exterior of the building needs some work, and then, of course, there's project management, and there is some concern that, given the age of the building, there may be some asbestos in a portion of the facility. I included some photos here to kind of show the status of the building, and I can just breeze through these, but the lighting and electrical are falling into disrepair. The roof, you can see several pieces of discoloration or chunks that we have repaired, but I can tell you right now we're missing some shingles due to a storm this winter. Our HVAC system is original, and while we have it serviced annually, it is just, it's older than me, or not older than me, but pretty close at this point. So we are in need to renovate it. Again, some finer finishes here and damage that should be repaired. I do want to call out the central picture here. This is an area that is in the upstairs of the facility and allows us to grow potatoes in the winter. I mentioned we send stuff to Hawaii to grow out and do our winter test, but if any lots fail to make it to Hawaii, we have grow lights here and the ability to grow out potatoes and then test them in our laboratory, something that we do regularly.
Do potatoes just grow better in Hawaii? I don't understand the Hawaii. I was just in Hawaii. It's a lovely place for a potato.
Madam Chair and committee members, they grow great in Minnesota, first of all, but they grow great in Hawaii in the winter. We've established a relationship with a farm in Hawaii that also grows for several other states doing this exact same thing. Mm-hmm. This farm is tailored to growing for seed potato certification. The weather is excellent. The conditions, of course, for walking. We rarely have a rain day, but the risk of disease intrusion or pathogen intrusion into the crop is minimal as well.
Oh, because it's isolated.
Exactly, yeah. And so we're able to go and be confident that what we're looking at is exactly what we would see in Minnesota, and we're not getting any false positives or negatives there. So,
I definitely think the committee needs to visit.
Could you take me, please? I've never attended. So with that, I come to the end of my presentation. This is a picture of the farm in Hawaii that we use to grow out those potatoes.
And I assume this is all in the governor's budget, Commissioner?
Yes.
Right, any questions from members of the committee about seed potatoes?
I'm Chair.
Or Hawaii. Senator Nelson.
Oh, it's always fun to talk about Hawaii, especially a day like today. But my question was, and I apologize if I missed it, is the request for $290,000? I'm just looking at your sheet.
In bonds.
On the proposed
and
request.
$85,000 in cash and $65,000 in the revolving loan.
Thank you very much. I missed that.
I could have let them answer. Sorry. Any other questions? Great, then thank you very much. We appreciate you coming today. And I'm whispering even though I have my mic on, so you all heard me. The IRRB, great. Welcome, Commissioner Rukavina, a name that just rolls off my tongue.
Thank you, Chair Pappas. We'll just take a minute here.
I will not say that I've known Commissioner Rukavina since she was 15 years old.
Maybe it could have been younger.
And Director Johnson. Welcome.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Pappas and members of the Senate Capital Investment Committee. For the record, my name is Ida Rukavina. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation. Thank you for the opportunity to present today this project and our agency's capital budget request. Our agency's request is for $16.6 million to replace failing underground infrastructure at Giants Ridge Recreation Area, which is a state asset located in northeastern Minnesota. The water line replacement will sustain this facility's recreational operations and provide fire suppression services. The facility's goals are to create economic impacts in northeastern Minnesota, provide recreational facilities to enhance quality of life for the people of northeastern Minnesota, attract private sector development, and operate as a year-round recreation destination. Giants Ridge attracted nearly 135,000 visits in fiscal year 2022 from Minnesota, the United States, and Canada. Private residential and lodging facilities have been built within the recreation area boundaries, which increased the local tax base. Giants Ridge has a substantial impact on the economy and the quality of life in northeastern Minnesota. The 2023 capital budget request would impact many population segments in the region and the state of Minnesota. Giants Ridge Recreation Area is located in Biwabik, which is on the eastern end of the Iron Range. It is a major economic development driver and diversifies the economy in the agency's service area. In 2020, the facility had an estimated annual economic impact of $55.4 million. And in 2019, Giants Ridge supported 179 jobs, including 133 full-time jobs employees, and the jobs are required to operate the recreation and private lodging facilities. Current existing waterline pipes are over 35 years old, and they have reached a crisis level of corrosion, damage, and deterioration. Without this project, the facility will soon be unable to make snow to support the winter operations, which are key to the region's economy. Giants Ridge is the region's recreational centerpiece. It is a major economic driver and part of the region's tourism industry. It provides jobs, direct and indirect economic impacts. It attracts visitors to the region who spend money there, and it improves the quality of life for the people who live there. The corrosion of the existing pipes can lead to eventual water leaking, which is not only inefficient, but could also contribute to wasting our natural resources. Investing in this new waterline infrastructure will lead to greater sustainability and more efficient use of the state's natural resources. These photos here, you'll see, the waterline replacement will replace 90% and automate 60% of the 35-year failing underground infrastructure and snowmaking system. You can see the corrosion and the deteriorating waterline pipes there. The waterline replacement project will increase efficiencies at the facility by maximizing the pump station to capacity. It will reduce water costs by 30% and be 40% more energy efficient. Cost savings will be attained through reduced repair costs, resulting in decreased downtime caused by equipment failure. And safety for employees will be improved through automation by limiting the hazards associated with manual transport, staging, and connecting of those snowmaking machines. Snowmaking machines have been used to slow the spread of wildfires. In September of 2021, firefighters struggled to contain a 204,000-acre wildfire and prevent hundreds of homes in two of California's most famous ski resorts, Heavenly and Kirkwood, from being destroyed. Workers at both of those ski resorts ran dozens of snowmaking machines around the clock to soak buildings and surrounding areas in an attempt to stop the advancing fire. Should the emergency ever arise in the East Range area, Giants Ridge could potentially be in a position to offer that same assistance. It is critical that the infrastructure needs at Giants Ridge be addressed through the capital budget request. Now is the time to act and help support the continued diversification of northeastern Minnesota's economy. Thank you, Senator Pappas, and members of the Senate Capital Investment Committee for the opportunity to present to you this project and our agency's capital budget request. I would also obviously like to take the time to invite you up to see Giants Ridge if you would like to. It's perfect ski season right now, but you're also welcome to come in the summer when there's golf. Thank you again for your time and for this opportunity.
Commissioner, has the stress on the snowmaking machines been somewhat alleviated this winter because of the amount of snow we've had? Or in order to make the, I'm not a downhill skier, so I don't know if, even if there is an abundance of snow, if you still need the machines to, I don't know, to do something.
Yeah,
Commissioner.
When we have heavy snows, it obviously alleviates and is helpful at the beginning of the year. Our snowmaking equipment is used towards the beginning of the season to get going. We typically open the Thanksgiving weekend. That's our goal, to make things operate and be efficient. So it was helpful, but we still have to use this snowmaking equipment to get our overall base.
Through the whole season?
Well,
early in the fall and then into the spring when the snow starts to melt. Do you want to, Ms. Johnson? She wants to jump in.
Yes, our snowmaking usually starts around Thanksgiving, right in the first part of November. Usually it's about 60 days of snowmaking. The new infrastructure would help reduce that and cut that down in half. So generally we try to finish before Christmas. Sometimes you have to go into the first part of November or January. But again, this new system will help with efficiencies for labor, energy savings, electricity, all of it.
So once the snow starts coming, then you rely less on the snowmaking machines. And then does it extend your season then longer into the spring? Do you use them then later in the winter?
Chair Pappas, we typically have not. We've typically been blessed with enough snow to just operate.
To last, right. Okay, thank you.
And cold.
Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think a lot of Minnesotans would be surprised to know that we own a ski resort, and the state owns a ski resort. And Madam Chair, my question for the commissioner is, for Giants Ridge, what is their net income? What's their operating income that they've seen over the last couple of years?
Is that Commissioner or Ms. Johnson?
Chair Pappas, let me, you can answer, actually. Sorry. Senator Rasmussen, thank you for the question. I am new to this role, so I am going to ask Director Johnson to, she has a better.
Chair Pappas, committee members, generally the IRRR funds the facility to the tune of approximately $12 to $14 million annually. And what happens with the revenue that comes in, it usually offsets about half, and we've continued to make great improvements and strides towards energy or labor efficiencies and increasing the attendance and the revenues that come into the property. And, over the years, we have attracted private sector development, which is one of our main drivers on the east end of the Iron Range where the facility is located. So $55 million annual economic impact goes into the region because of the Giants Ridge economic impact. And the subsidy, we believe, far offsets the overall economic economy that the facility brings into the region.
Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the question there. So just to make sure I understand, if we were to think about kind of the net cash flow going from IRRB to Giants Ridge for operation, am I understanding it's about $12 to $14 million a year?
Correct, Madam Chair. Committee members, correct.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, and I would just say, if we're going to, as a state, be operating a ski resort, I think we should also be looking at the business case for that, especially if the state is putting $12 to $14 million into an operation that's losing money. I think we do have to look at the business case and see if there's something that we can do to try to have it so it's not not only taking resources from IRRB, but potentially taking resources in general obligation bonds as well. But I appreciate the answer.
I don't think the state doesn't participate in the operating costs. That's just IRRB. But we are being asked to help with the capital costs. Correct. Senator Commissioner.
Chair Pappas, thank you. I was just going to say it was one of our directions. So it was in the early 80s that the facility purchased the Giants Ridge facility to expand and diversify the economy, and we believe throughout the years has created jobs and recreational facilities for the people and residents, not only in the taconite assistance area, but throughout the state that use it.
Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. My question was on slide 5, 179 jobs. You don't have to look at the slide. That was just my question. It's about the 179 jobs. I want to know, are those current jobs? Are those new jobs that would be generated because of, should the bonding request be fulfilled? Just kind of tell me about the 179 jobs.
Chair Pappas, Senator Nelson, those are current positions. So that was in 2019, which was the last year we did that exact study. So those were current job positions at that time. It wouldn't be new because of this. This is just there would be no new jobs because of this bonding request.
Thank you.
Except for the, I'm sorry, and I should say, to clarify, except for the labor, because it would be a significant amount of construction hours.
Right. Thank you. That was my question.
Commissioner, do you contract them with a management company to run the ski resort, or do you, you don't manage it directly?
Chair Pappas, correct. The IRRR used to manage, and it was a number of years ago when we contracted out with a facility that manages it, the facility.
Senator Housley.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner and Ms. Johnson. My question is, what was the last, since the bonding bill didn't get done last year, what was your ask in the previous bonding cycle?
Chair Pappas.
Ms. Johnson.
Committee members, last time when we started this about 8 years ago, it was 8.1, and then it went up to 10.1, and now we're at 16.6. So a lot of that is in due to inflation, and because this project is more infrastructure related, it's pipe, electrical, those types of commodities, the inflation rates and the supply chain has just, you know, gone through the roof. And so the longer we wait, the more expensive it is.
Senator Housley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Johnson, and Commissioner. So did you go out and get another bid? Because I know a lot of these projects are coming in at 20% inflation, some less. So this is, 20% would be $12 million, so, or 12.2 or something like that. Did you get a whole new bid for the whole project?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Johnson.
Committee members. We worked with Real Estate Construction Services and admin and added the 20% through the midpoint construction for the inflation rate. And that's how our project went from, you know, the last ask to now the 16.6. So we worked right with admin to get the inflation and the amount to current levels.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam President, or Madam Chair. And Commissioner, just I was kind of interested by Senator Rasmussen's question. I just wanted to follow up a little bit. So as we had mentioned, and you know, as you and I had the conversation about the IRRRB being having a responsibility for diversifying the range economy, so it can better handle the ups and downs of taconite mining. The 12 point something million that you're funding, is that coming out of the taconite production tax?
Correct. Chair Pappas, Senator Pratt, correct. That is correct.
Commissioner. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, you know, I'm kind of wondering, when you have an asset like this that's generating revenue, it's being subsidized a little bit by the taconite production tax. And I think back to, you know, even my school board days when we were putting money away for deferred maintenance for, you know, the very items that you're talking about. I'm just kind of curious as far as what do you have set aside for deferred maintenance on a project like this when, you know, you do have ski lifts and you do have infrastructure that's going to age out and it has a useful life, and it's none of this is really a surprise, right?
Chair Pappas, Senator Nelson, thank you for that. Yes, I would like to kind of just explain some of the what we've done as an agency over the years, just so the committee knows. So the agency's invested over $120 million in Giants Ridge since 1984. We have, through capital projects, there's been over $60 million operations throughout the years, and there is a plan. You know, we have been talking about the capital improvements and those upcoming costs. Director Johnson has a little bit more in that.
Chair Pappas and committee members, we have just most recently over the last 4 to 5 years been putting a capital fund aside of $500,000 a year to continue to build a fund that eventually, again, we would invest. We're still waiting on some approvals from the State Board of Investment. We would take that money that we are putting aside and invest and let that grow. And long term, that is kind of our vision in the next 10 to 20 years, that would help offset any shortfalls in revenue. So that's our long-term, plus help with those capital expenditures, because we do have a long list of deferred maintenance that we continue to go after. And this piece, again, we've been here for many, many years asking to help with this project, and it's a major capital investment. Again, it's the economic driver for our region. We are located in a depressed area of the state. This is our diversification. When LTV Mining Company closed in 2000, if it wasn't for the Giants Ridge facility, the east end of the Iron Range would be even more devastated than it is today. And so this is what has kept the traffic moving to our region. This is what's provided a quality of life for the people. This is what's kept people in our region. As you can imagine, people move out of our region when there's no place to work. And if we don't continue to diversify our assets and what we have in our natural resources, pretty soon we will not have an economy in northern Minnesota. And so that's what this project is. We ask for your help today, and thank you.
Senator Pratt.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm not questioning, you know, the value of the asset that we have. Not at all. But it's a different kind of asset than I think we're talking about when we are looking at deferred maintenance for, you know, other state buildings that are more office related or along that line. I mean, this is truly one where we've got we're competing with, you know, with some private industry, not here, but I mean, you know, we do have near me, we have Buck Hill, we have Afton Alps and others that, you know, maybe closer to the metro. And this is, I'm not saying, we've talked extensively in the jobs committee about the types of jobs and making sure that there's workforce development in order to fill the needs that are there. I'm not debating that at all. But I'm kind of curious, and again, I had a, prior to being in the Senate, you know, I was on the education side where we were putting money away for deferred maintenance, and we didn't have the type of cash flow that someone has, and if I'm looking at $16.6 million, it's not a lot to bond for, quite honestly, but it also seems like something that I would like to see Giants Ridge become a little bit more self-sustaining. I think that was the goal and the objective when we bought it, invested it, in developing it, that at some point in time it would become self-sustaining. I get that you have to have cash reserves on hand, and you know, when operating costs go, you know, fall short. Pandemic would be probably a perfect example of when that happened. And that's not what we're talking about. But we are talking about the fact that facilities like this and all the equipment in the facilities have a useful life. And it's very, very plannable. And I would like to see more from Giants Ridge on that standpoint becoming more self-sustaining, because I think that was probably the objective when it was purchased.
Senator Nelson.
So just a very brief question, not totally related to the bonding proposal, but I thought I heard you mention that you were looking to invest $500,000 per year. You're waiting for a letter from the state. Are you looking at investing that in the state investment board?
Ms. Johnson.
Chairman Pappas, committee members, yes. And so we've been trying to do that the last couple years, and we haven't had much luck. So we are putting that aside. So we continue to put that aside in the hopes that we can get this into the State Board of Investment, and again, continue to grow that account.
So, question?
Ms. Nelson.
Thank you so much. Well, just a follow up, why does it, is it required that it be in the State Investment Board, or why not invest in, you know, there's lots of investments around the state, investment firms. Must it be in the State Investment Board? I don't know.
Chairman Pappas, committee members,
I
can't really answer that. That's the route that we've taken over the past several years, and we haven't been successful. I don't know the rules of engagement as it relates to if it has to be in the State Board of Investment or can it be in a private sector account.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Senator Nelson.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So I guess the question is, whose money is it? Is it IRRRB money? And that's the question. Can IRRRB invest in private business? I think it does. But anyway, just a question to consider moving forward, maybe not being limited by involvement in the state investment board, but perhaps looking at other ways to do that, really planning for deferred maintenance.
Thank you. Just a comment. So in the 2022 bonding season, your request was 10.1 million. So a 20% kind of inflation adjustment would have brought it to 12.5. How did it get to 16.6?
Chairman Pappas, committee members, I'm probably losing track. It's been so long. So part of it is last year, were we at 12.2? And the prior year was probably the 10.1.
Whatever you need to do, the waterline replacement and some of this, can it be phased at all? Can you make progress with not the total amount of money, but, you know, a large portion of it? I'm not sure I can get to 16.6.
Chairman Pappas, committee members, this project probably cannot be phased. If we were to be successful and obtain bonding funding, the project would probably start in 2024 in the summer, and we would get it in the ground and completed prior to the following winter. Because again, it costs money to mobilize and everything else, so we'd like to just get it done and completed over a construction season.
Right. Any questions? All right, thank you very much. We'll do our best.
Thank you.
Welcome, Major General Mankey and Executive Director Kerr. Thank you. Proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Major General Sean Mankey, the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, and I brought with me today Mr. Don Kerr, the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs, and we're going to present our capital request today. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. Very pleased to be here today, and I'm going to take you through the Governor's approved bonding proposal that we have for the Department of Military Affairs. Pretty simple, really only two items. I'll spend a little time on this as we go through, because this is kind of everything that we've got on here, Madam Chair, is a carry forward from last year's bonding process with some inflation added. Where it gets a little bit weird is we used to have, in last year's request, we had individual line items for the four projects that are consolidated in the first request. And as we worked with MMB, the Department of Admin, and our own team to try to determine what is the appropriate inflationary amount, we thought it might be prudent, rather than try to guess all four targets really closely, to aggregate those. And we felt that way we'd know we'd be able to fund most of the projects or all of them without failing on any one that would stop us from doing it. So what you'll see here, and there's a little bit more detail when we get to the individual slides that will give you some insight as to what the previous requests were, but this is our increase. The projects listed in the first request were actually approved in the 2020 bonding request, and as you're hearing from everyone, as we actually went out to the street to get these things done, the inflationary pressures just creamed us, and we ran into some unbelievable cost increases in some of these projects. We were able to keep some of them moving, in many cases by using our internal funding that normally is set aside for asset preservation inside the base budget of the agency, but it was important enough to keep these projects going So we were able to do that. And so far, we don't have any misfires on anything. I would like to tell the committee, though, we are in a little bit of a dilemma with Marshall in that in all cases, we match federal funding with our state funding. And Madam Chair, I know a couple of committees ago you mentioned that sometimes the state legislature hasn't been the best partner in some of these events. Our other partner is the federal government, so we think you're just fine. Trying to coordinate the funding streams between the two government entities can be somewhat challenging, but we did get funding for Marshall that we had to push off on the federal side, and that funding is annual appropriation. They were very agreeable to continuing to extend that funding, but we are concerned that if we don't get this funding this year, we'll lose the Marshall project on the federal side and have to go back to square one. And it will continue to get more expensive, as we've seen in the past. The second project is actually the phase two of one of the projects in the first phase. The Rosemont project we knew was going to be very large, so we split that into design and construction. And now we're coming back in for the second phase. So you'll notice Rosemont is listed in the first one. That was a shortfall we had in the design funding. And now we're also coming in to ask for the actual project funding. We have had designers working on that renovation, and so we have a much better feel, we think, much greater confidence in the estimate that we have. But that's kind of what the sum is. So $31,487,000 in the governor's budget. And I'm going to go through. To give you an idea, so we have about 60 armories, and I say about because the number moves around as we gain and divest of facilities. But there are about 60 armories in Minnesota that the state has to do some maintenance on. The federal government shares that maintenance responsibility with us. And so we're always trying to manage the federal dollars and the state dollars at the same time. But the bottom line is we've kind of come to this conclusion that with these 60 armories, they all seem to need a roof about every 20 years. They all need new windows about every 20 years. And so doing knucklehead math, I'm an infantryman, so I have to keep things simple. 60 facilities, we need to do about 3 a year to keep this thing, keep the wheels on the bus. And that gets us into every facility in every 20 to 25 years. It doesn't work out exactly that way because we do have some facilities that we know we're going to divest of, and so we aren't putting any money into those. So far, and we've been on this path for about 25 years. We kind of adopted this methodology of going in and doing what we call a batch project, where rather than doing a roof as it fails and a furnace 3 years later and the electrical system 5 years after that, we're looking at these facilities in about a 20-year cycle and saying, okay, we're going in, we're doing roofs, windows, bringing everything up to code, and getting everybody out of there for the year so we can do the construction, then get the unit back in. And those batch projects are what we're pushing here. But these are the types of things that we do.
Well, Mr. Kerr, where do you get the money to do your batch projects to your asset preservation?
Madam Chair, typically these are the bond projects that we're coming in for, uh-huh, along with the federal funding that we match with it. And okay, so we have a very interesting process with the federal government that forecasts what we believe our needs are going to be in coming years by telling them what we intend to do. And this has actually been very helpful for us because previously we literally were managing each individual based on each individual problem we had with it, rather than trying to group these things together. And now being able to go in and forecast with some certainty to the National Guard Bureau and to the legislature what we're going to need, when we're going to need it. And we do have a long list that we'd be happy to share with the committee if you wanted to see it, Madam Chair. We actually have invested a lot of energy in this, and I've been doing this part of this work now for just over 20 years, both on the military side before and then in my civilian capacity later. And it's really been an interesting thing to see the evolution of how our team has gotten together to try to manage all of the difficulties that we have. We have many armories that are over 100 years old. We have many armories that we know are no longer in the right places in Minnesota. They may have been in the right place 100 years ago, but they're not anymore. And how do we deal with keeping the inventory of our facilities modernized so that they meet the requirements of modern military service, keep the communities happy because they are community resources, particularly in greater Minnesota, but because nobody's happy when we come tell them we're going to take your armory away. They don't like that very much, we found. Can be a very difficult conversation. But at some point, we have to look at not continuing to maintain a facility that isn't doing what it needs to do and is really more of a burden than an asset for us. So about 15 years ago, the United States Senate directed and funded something called the Readiness Center Transformation Master Plan, the RCTMP. They love acronyms. And it was a federal contract that came out, and we did a very professional assessment of our entire inventory with a direction to looking at how can we replace the footprint of armories. And the beautiful vision that they had was they really think each state ought to go down about 3 armories, all located at the intersections of interstate highways, and just make everybody drive to where those armories are. And it briefs really well when you're the guy that has to figure out how to pay for maintenance, because you just reduced your difficulty tremendously. But it doesn't work very well when there's a tornado someplace and you got to go find a base of operations to start working from to help that local community. So we're torn between having a lot of places that we have a footprint from which to work to support the people of Minnesota and trying to get the efficiencies down. The other thing that's been interesting is we continue to change the standards that are necessary from the federal government side. And they have very, very defined standards of how many square feet you get for everything that we do and what type of space you get for that square footage. And it's wonderful from a quality of life perspective. It's miserable from a maintenance and sustainability perspective because we have started building really big buildings. 100 years ago, we built small armories, couple of classrooms, big drill floor, a little bit of maintenance area. And at that time, when a soldier enlisted in the National Guard, you got a canteen and a pistol belt and a pair of boots, and that was about it. Now, we're issuing our soldiers 4 giant foot lockers full of really expensive equipment that's supposed to be stored in the armories. Well, if you're going to store it in the armories, you got to have space in the armories. So the new criteria result in us building these ginormous facilities, which is wonderful, until it's 25 years later and you got to put a roof on it. And that's where we're at right now. We're starting to see the era where all of our 1950s and 70s and 60s armories have all been renovated, and we're kind of out of old armories to renovate, and we're going to have to start renovating new armories. And Rosemont is the first one of those truly new armories, although Moorhead's kind of in that category as well.
Director Kerr, do you have an asset preservation request then for us this year?
Madam Chair, we get asset preservation funding in our base budget. So we generally don't come to the bonding committee except
for... That was my earlier question,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, funding to do the batch projects. So these are batch projects. The Rosemont Readiness Center is a major renovation of that facility. 28 years old, so we're a little bit behind our timeline, but we've been working on this for a little while. 99,000 square feet, so it's a pretty big building. We got $1 million approved in the 2020 bonding bill to start the design. We had to throw a little bit of our own asset preservation money in to make that whole so we could continue to get there. And now our completion for the project, that has grown to $24,720,000. That's a high confidence number. We're pretty sure that's a good number. One of the things that's going to be really expensive about Rosemont that I find sort of intriguing, and I know the committee has visited Rosemont if you're a returning member, we use kind of a cutting-edge HVAC system to control the heating in a very large building. It was all pneumatic. And there's something like 26 miles of quarter-inch vinyl tubing in the walls that seemed like a good idea at the time, but 25 years later we're finding maybe hasn't held up as well. And so that's all going to have to be pulled out of there and replaced with a more conventional control system. So there are some very interesting things about the Rosemont Readiness Center. It is one of our flagship armories, though, and so we think it's very important to continue to invest, and that $24,720,000 will get that project completed and create a wonderful facility for another 30 years or so at least. The Moorhead Readiness Center, this project is in progress right now. 5.345 was already approved. With the funding that we've thrown in, we think that shortfall right now is $855,000 to get that project wrapped up. This is, again, one of our very important armories in outstate Minnesota, and a big one that I'm very close to. I served there for a number of years, and a very important project. The Marshall Readiness Center, again, this is the one that we're really kind of worried about. You'll see there's been a massive cost increase here. This is one of our last older armories that hasn't been renovated yet. And this one was in kind of rougher shape, and we had to do an addition to it to make up for some of the shortage of square footage. So this one came, this is one of the big surprises that we had when we actually started looking at what the building was going to cost based on our original estimate. It just came in out of the ballpark. But an additional 4.752, and again, this one is, we're in danger of losing the federal funding if we don't get this done this year. The Fergus Falls Readiness Center. Interestingly, the Fergus Falls facility has held up really well over time. It's 65 years old, and we're going to get this one done relatively inexpensively in the big scheme of things. And I don't really know why that is exactly, except if it's in the right spot, perhaps.
Excuse me, Mr. Kerr. Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment. We take care of our things in Fergus Falls. So, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Rasmussen. I'll get back to that in a second. So, again, Madam Chair, this is the total. Those four projects consolidated into 6.6, well, 3.5, depending on how you count Rosemont. It's in both categories. One is the design previous, and the other is the actual change item for $31,487,000. And I would like to add at this time, thank you, Senator Rasmussen. He is one of the authors of a bill that was it's been introduced and sent to the committee, Senate File 71, I believe, which is the bonding projects that were on the table last year. Senator May Quaid is the author of the bill. We've provided some language and asked her to consider amending it to bring it into alignment with the governor's recommendations, and she's agreed to do that. So at some point, I'll be back in front of you again, I assume, to talk about that bill, but that's basically what this is about. We appreciate the support from both sides of the aisle in getting that bill moving, and would appreciate the committee's support in our projects.
Great, thank you. Any questions? Oh, Senator Friends. With Senator Friends. He hasn't had a question yet, I think.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Kern. Thank you, General. When we hear danger of losing federal funds, I always want to make sure we understand that. Do you mind saying a little more about that?
Mr. Kern.
Madam Chair, Senator Friends, so when, again, because we have to try to align when we're doing these matched projects with our funding from the federal government, which is very difficult to forecast because of the way they appropriate, we have program managers that are tracking the programs on the federal side for future fund allocation, and of course they're working their magic with the books to try to figure out what kind of money has to be set aside for projects in Minnesota versus Montana and Georgia and everywhere else, and getting all those things aligned. If a state fails to execute its project, the federal money turns into a pumpkin if they don't spend it on something. So they move that money to another project, and it doesn't stay on the table. So you can't automatically assume that if you aren't executing on time that the federal funds will be available. So we work really hard to try to make sure that we align projects on the federal side so that there'll be state money available to match at the appropriate time.
Madam Chair.
Senator Friends.
Thank you. And am I understanding correctly, your greatest concern amongst these is the Marshall Project?
Madam Chair, Senator Friends, yes, that's our greatest concern, because the Marshall Project, because of the size of it, that's, as we were trying to figure out how to keep moving forward with the other ones by using our internal funding, we kind of made the decision, okay, we think we can get this one and this one, but we can't get to that one, it's the bridge too far, so we have to push that back in the queue. And as you know, the bond proceeds are available for about 5 years, depending on when you pass the bill. But the federal funding isn't, and so we have to get the federal funds aligned into somewhere in that five-year period. And it's a really beautiful dance, actually. Watching the development of how our team has tried to get their arms around the problems so that we can apply the rule set inside the state to be in alignment with the federal government, and keeping enough freedom of action to take advantage of opportunities, because sometimes those federal projects that get canceled in other states suddenly become available. It's like, hey, can you do something in the next 90 days? Because all of, you know, Arizona's blowing this project and we got to get it spent or it's going to go away. And sometimes we're able to acquire additional federal funding that can be spent in Minnesota and alleviate some of our deferred maintenance concerns at the same time. So
it does concern me that entire projects are held up because you have a shortfall in funding. And if we're not doing kind of regular bonding bills to rectify that, or we don't have some flexibility in, you know, being able to move funds, if, you know, you're short in Moorhead, to move it from Marshall to actually complete Moorhead and complete Fergus Falls, which are just smaller projects, and then come back for just the rest of the money from Marshall. I mean, I don't know if that's possible to do with our bonding rules, but it just to hold up all three because you're short is really a shame for so many years.
Well, Madam Chair, if I can address that, that's one reason we kind of agreed with the language that was proposed in that consortium between admin MMB and the agency, rather than tying to a fixed number for one particular project and each one. If we're off in each one, we can't get any of them done. So right. if we can try to, but at the same time, I understand the need for legislative oversight of what we're doing, and we don't think that we should get a free hand in anything either. So walking that line has been very challenging, very interesting balance, and sometimes we can bring additional federal funds to bear to make up some shortfalls, but we work really hard to make sure we get as much federal money as we can to make the state money go as far as we can.
Mr. Curran, my opinion is less an issue of federal of state oversight and more of following the rules that are laid down by MMB and bond council. So if we can work out something there, I would much rather give you that flexibility. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation, excellent presentation, and thank you for your service. I just have a really brief question. On the Moorhead and the Marshall Readiness Centers, there was bonding appropriated for that. I understand there was Rosemont too, but that was just design, so finishing up that design. But I'm just curious, the additional request for each, both Moorhead and Marshall, is that because, you might have mentioned this, but is that because of the inflation factor or something else?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, so we've seen this a lot. You know, some of the rules for participating as a contractor in a, and we have to follow both federal and state rules, which is interesting because sometimes there's conflict between those. You have kind of a limited pool of companies that are eligible to perform those general contracting procedures for those big jobs. And these are big jobs. And so sometimes when we get outside the metropolitan area, the pool of interested contractors is sometimes small. And if you own a construction company in the Twin Cities and you're going to bid on a project in Marshall, you're going to have to add a lot of mobilization cost into your bid. And particularly when you're looking at what kind of materials do I need for that, where are those materials going to come from? In the last 3 years, we know there have been huge supply chain issues, and those things have all influenced that bid process, so that we're seeing some very high numbers.
Any other questions? Great, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So members, especially my colleagues, thank you, you're done. Thank you, General, so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So members, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, just some arguments for you to bring to your caucus about how important it is for us to do regular bonding bills and how significant this inflation issue is. Because we are seeing significant increases, and even as we're negotiating last year's bill right now, because we didn't pass it last year, we're having problems adjusting the numbers to accommodate the projects that were in last year's bill that, of course, no one saw, but a few of us. But let me reassure you that they are great projects, and your caucus will love them all, but they are more expensive than they were last year. Great. Thank you so much. I think we're not going to have a meeting on Thursday. We have a floor session, and I'm concerned the floor session will go long, so I don't want to invite, MMB was going to come and present to us, and I don't want to invite them and then have to cancel, so we just already canceled our committee on Thursday. Meeting is adjourned.